This is tape number 3, side number 2 of the missing dimension in 6.
With animals, there is no marriage, no home, no family relationship, no husband and wife sexual love relationship. Females are sexless between rutting periods. Female humans do not have a rutting period or a mating period when they are in heat. Between the age of puberty and the time of menopause, roughly between ages 14 and 44, or a duration of approximately 30 years, women have the monthly period approximately each 28 days when they menstruate. Female animals do not menstruate. But when in heat, the female animal is beside herself with desire for mating, and until she is relieved by the fertilization of the ripe ovum from coital breeding by the male of her kind, she knows no rest. Actually, unless the female animal is soon bred, she will make every effort, run any risk, to attain pregnancy. But in women, such things are utterly different. Women are never in heat. The presence of an ovum in a fallopian tube, when it is ready to be fertilized, makes little or no difference in either a woman's desire for or reluctance against sexual intercourse. The Kinsey reports and other surveys of doctors have shown that in many, if not most women, no difference whatever is noted. In the minority, the difference in either desire or abhorrence is slight and merely relative. What does all this mean? It means that, except for purposes of producing progeny, the functions and responses of sex in women are entirely different from sex in animals. Although marital coitus should never, of course, occur during menstruation, see Ezekiel 18:6 and parallel scriptures, there is no time during the month when a woman is virtually sexless, when sex functioning goes dormant, when she is unable to engage in coitus with her husband. She is as much capable of coitus at one time as another. God made woman as well as man on a plane infinitely higher than animals. He created sex in humans as a means of bestowing reciprocal love. He created women so that their sex organs may be used for the purpose of sharing love when pregnancy is virtually impossible, at least when the rhythm method advocates say it is. Animals do not marry. The use of sex for breeding purposes in animals is not a matter of love making. Can you imagine a big bull and a cow in passionate embrace with their arms around each other? That is, trying to wrap their front legs with their hoofs around each other, trying to hug and kiss and caress and make love? If a circus could ever train a bull and a cow to put on such an act, it would be sure to bring the house down with side-splitting laughter. You may be sure the circus people would have thought of that and done it long ago if it were possible to train a bull and a cow to go into a love embrace. Sex serves no purpose of love with animals. With mammals, reproduction is brought about by the same process as in humans, but animals do not marry. Animals do not have either the philia or the eros love. Animals cannot receive the agape love from God. With animals, sex does not stimulate desire for love, or for that matter, for lust. Why do people refer to human lust as animal passion? Why do some women say men are brutes? Why insult the animals? They do only what God set their brains to cause them to do by instinct. In women, sex is a love stimulant. Women can, and usually do, engage in sex as a love embrace, even at times when pregnancy is impossible. Female animals cannot. When a female animal is served by the male, there is no love embrace, no love making. The male mounts on the back of the female, imparts the fertilizing spermatozoa, and departs. Human bodies were deliberately designed by God in a different manner, so that sex in humans becomes an embrace of love. What evolutionists don't know. The evolutionists, in willful and inexcusable ignorance, classify man with the animal kingdom. There was no intelligent creator. There was no rational, thoughtful, and wise planning and designing with purpose. In their stubborn, irrational rebellion against revelation, they formulate and religiously embrace in blind faith ridiculous and vanity-inspired fables. They cling defiantly to the postulate that man descended over millions of years from animals similar and ancestral to the anthropoid ape. All this by hereditary reproduction brought about by natural processes and resident forces. How, when, and why, then, did animal instinct disappear and human mind with its human spirit arrive on the scene? And if no intelligent God designed and created sex for definite purposes, just how do we explain these amazing sex differences between animals and humans? And why such a total gap in fossil findings? Why no intermediate species? There is yet one other amazing factor the evolutionist will have difficulty in explaining, and that is what happens after human menopause. Women have been given a duration of approximately 30 years of fertility, during which they may become mothers. At an age averaging 13 or 14, girls reach the age of puberty. At that age, their breasts develop for the purpose of supplying milk to newborn babies. Their sex organs mature, and their ovaries begin to produce ova. These egg cells usually are produced at the rate of one every 28 days, alternating from each ovary. If the ovum is fertilized in the fallopian tube, a new human life has been begotten. It then continues on into the womb or uterus, where it is protected, nourished, and gradually developed, ready to be born after approximately 9 months. But if the ovum is not met by a sperm cell and fertilized, and some doctors say it has a life of only 48 hours after leaving the ovary, it dies. Meanwhile, with the releasing of each egg cell from an ovary, the uterus has been prepared to receive a fertilized embryo. But if fertilization did not take place, then the womb discharges a little blood through the vagina gradually over a period of about 5 days. This is called menstruation. Although the menstrual period occurs generally about every 28 days, many, if not most, girls experience irregularity beginning at the age of puberty. Sometimes this irregularity persists for some years before a regular rhythm is established. Unless this irregularity is quite excessive, as soon as a girl begins her menstrual periods, she is physically capable of becoming a mother, but she is not yet for some years mentally and emotionally mature enough for motherhood. This physical capacity for reproduction continues for approximately 30 years. Then a woman reaches the change of life period called menopause. After menopause, some women reach this period of change at about age 40, some rarely as late as age 50. The average will be somewhere around 45. This menopause is a more or less trying experience. There will be nervousness, often complaint of hot flashes, and sometimes neurotic disturbances. The discomfiture depends largely on physical, mental, and emotional health. Some women foolishly have internal sex organs removed by surgery at this time, only to discover later that they obtained temporary relief at cost of greatly increased mental problems as well as physical. But why this menopause stage? Here again, the wise design of a loving, all-intelligent creator is emphasized. After this stage of life, women simply should no longer carry the responsibility of caring for babies and training young children. Children begin to get on their nerves. Neither women nor men ever reach the age where they no longer enjoy children. You see, this is the age when they usually become grandparents. God has designed things so that all grandparents find their own grandchildren are just as sweet, lovely, and dear to them as their own. They now have the privilege, barring geographical separation, of enjoying the grandchildren, on occasion. It is a real joy to see the little tots come scampering into the grandparents' home, but after an hour or two or three, it is somehow a welcome relief when their parents take the kiddies home. Grandma just simply ought not be burdened down too often with the care and responsibility of the children. So there was intelligence, wisdom, loving concern in the designing hand of the Creator. When a woman reaches this stage of life, her ovaries cease manufacturing ova. No such change takes place in men. There is a mild sort of menopause in men, more mental than physical, but men may become fathers into a very ripe old age. But what about expressing love through sex? The Creator designed human sex, but not animal sex, as a means of expressing pure, righteous, and undefiled love. And God commands, husbands, love your wives. And also for women, to love their own husbands. Now, should a husband and wife stop loving each other after age 45 or 50? Never. And so a benevolent, loving God designed women so that they are freed from exposure to pregnancies after this stage of life, but their participation in sexual love with their husbands does not cease. Actually, most women are either less reluctant, if inhibited by the dualistic repression, or else more desirous of sexual intercourse with their husbands after this period than they were before. It is true that after this age, physical sex drives in both sexes begin to slow down gradually. The act of coitus will not be desired quite so often. But if the wife slows down, so also does her husband. So a God who had great outgoing concern for us, his own potential children, designed humans so that husband and wife continue to be endeared to each other by coitus all through life. And if that is true of expression of physical love, the giving of spiritual love by those endowed with God's Spirit, conversely, should intensify and deepen as the years flit by. Marriage is ordained until death do us part. One purpose of marriage is sexual love. When the other purpose, childbearing, ceases, sexual love continues to draw husband and wife ever closer in the bond of true love until death parts them. Can anyone contemplate these wonderful facts of the Creator's wisdom and love and power without an emotional feeling of awe, reverence, respect, and gratitude? How wonderful are the works of God's hands! So we have these marked differences between human and animal females. These physical, biological differences, as well as God's Word, prove that sex in humans was designed for a purpose not applicable to animals. It was designed for marriage, for family relationship, for expression of love between husband and wife. And sex provides the means for this bestowal of love until death do us part, even into old age. Chapter 9. How God Designed Sex. Man has produced many highly complicated mechanisms out of matter he has appropriated from the ground. The huge, intricately designed modern newspaper and magazine presses bring exclamations of amazement from visitors seeing one for the first time. I am reminded of this because we have a number of these big magazine presses in our enlarged printing plants in Radlett, England, and North City, Australia, and previously in Pasadena, California. Awe-inspiring mechanism. But the largest, most complicated machines man has designed pale to insignificance beside the most wonderful of all mechanisms, the human body and mind. This awe-inspiring mechanism also was formed from matter out of the ground. It was the supreme masterpiece of God's great creative handiwork. The Almighty formed man after his own likeness, and his spiritual creation is still in process. God reveals much about himself. He is composed of spirit, not matter. He is a God of supreme mind. He tells us he has eyes, ears, nose, mouth. He has arms and legs, feet and hands. He wrote the Ten Commandments on stone tablets with his own finger. The marvelous human body is formed and shaped like God, unlike any other creature. Yet God, being spirit, possesses inherent eternal life. He has endowed man with only a limited physical existence, sustained chemically in principle, much like the motor in your car. So God designed in the human body two basic types of systems. One is the life-sustaining apparatus. This includes the highly complicated digestive, circulatory, respiratory, and other systems. These are coordinated in functioning by the nervous system, which in turn is directly connected with the mind. The other basic system is the genital or sex system, making humans male and female. This has no direct part in sustaining the individual's existence. It serves to perpetuate not the individual, but the race. But it also generates love and a desire to marry a certain one and stimulates marital love to preserve the home and family. This genital system, too, is connected by the nervous system directly with the mind. These two general systems serve different purposes, yet there is a connection between the two. The genital apparatus exercises a considerable influence on the life-sustaining functions. The female sex hormones cause a woman's body and mind to be feminine. The male sex hormones cause a man's body and mind to be masculine. Also, there is a closer analogy between male and female sex organs and sex functioning than is generally understood. It is the genital system that we need here to describe. We shall use in this description of sex anatomy and functioning the medical or scientific terminology. I strongly urge all parents to learn these terms and to use them in teaching their children. If it were not entirely too embarrassing, a social gathering could be given a hilarious evening by each, one at a time, saying right out loud the names for sex organs and functions, especially the eliminative functions which their mothers taught them. Probably no two people at the party would reveal the same terminology. Every young mother seems to think up some new outlandish names for such things. It becomes a part of a secret language. If I might at this point be permitted one digression intended to be humorous, I should like to mention the cute saying of a year-and-a-half-old girl. Her mother had tried to break her bedwetting by making a shaming face and uttering a sound something like k-k-k. In her baby talk, this little girl soon began to call this particular means of elimination by a term she pronounced "coo," almost like "coo." Then one day, for the first time in her life, the little girl saw an ocean. She was tremendously impressed by its magnitude. "Oh, Mommy," she exclaimed excitedly, "Ocean Coupang." Pang was her baby talk for panties. The adults haven't stopped laughing yet. The moral is, children should be taught the proper professional terms rather than some weird terminology of your own devising. Three functional categories. We humans cannot live the clean and happy lives the Creator intended and made possible unless we understand His purposes and the laws regulating sex functions. This is true regardless of age, sex, or marriage status. It applies to all from the age of puberty. And there are many things about sex which parents need to teach children as soon as little minds begin to become curious about little bodies. This book is not intended to be a technical scientific textbook to educate professionals, though certainly every doctor, psychiatrist, or other professional dealing with sex ought to know what has been covered in this book. It is, however, the purpose of this book to reveal not only God's purposes and the right attitude toward sex, but those basic, though somewhat elementary, biological facts which ought to be known by teenagers as well as the marriageable and the married. Man, utterly unlike animals, arrives at sexual maturity several years before he achieves mental, emotional, and social maturity. Boys and girls are capable of becoming parents years before they are qualified for the responsibilities of parenthood. Teenagers need this knowledge for their own protection. In this age of pressures toward promiscuity, blinded by false teachings, adolescents cannot be expected to resist premarital sex unless their minds are open to intelligent acceptance of God's purposes and laws. Also, all married people need this knowledge if their marriages are to be preserved in happiness. It is the lack of this knowledge which has caused 90% of all marital unhappiness, contention, separation, and divorce. None can understand what he needs to know without an elementary knowledge of the anatomy of sex organs, as well as some knowledge of sex stimuli and sex functioning. And so we approach here the necessary knowledge of anatomy and functioning in a manner quite different from that which has been commonly used. The genital system is composed of three functional categories. These are, 1, glands. These produce the germinal cells and the hormones. In the male, these glands are called testes, or testicles, and in the female, ovaries. 2, ducts. These tubes transport the germinating cells from testes and ovaries and render possible fertilization. In the male, they are the vasa efferentia, the epididymis, the vas deferens, the ejaculatory duct, and the urethra. In the female, they are the fallopian tubes or oviducts through which the ovum is carried from the ovary to the uterus. 3, organs of copulation. Through these, the male germinal cells, called spermatozoa, reach the ovum for fertilization. These organs are, in the male, the penis, and in the female, the vagina. The fertilized ovum remains in the female uterus, or womb, where it is nourished and developed sufficiently to be born. The body, like the church. No book I have examined and researched on sex anatomy and functions makes any mention of the great architect who planned, designed, and produced it. Sex is viewed coldly merely as something man finds he has, not knowing why or anything of the designer's purposes, knowing only what he sees and, in his self-centered concupiscent human nature, experiences. But the Eternal, in his instruction book for mankind, compares the marvelous human body to God's church, which is the body of Christ. The various members in God's church have various function, and God provides them with various spiritual gifts for performance of these functions. This is found in the chapter devoted to the spiritual gifts, the 12th of 1 Corinthians. The human body, like God's true church, is not composed of one member, but many. It is the same with God. As explained previously, the biblical instruction book reveals God as a divine family, only the one God, but composed of more than one divine person. So with the church. And so likewise with the God-designed human body, made in the likeness of God. Here then we see still another manner in which man is made in the likeness of God. One God, more than one person, one human body, more than one member. Also, one church, more than one member. Notice, if the foot shall say, because I am not the hand, I am not of the body, and if the ear shall say, because I am not the eye, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? If the whole body were an eye, where were the hearing? If the whole were hearing, where were the smelling? But now has God set the members, every one of them, in the body as it has pleased him. 1 Corinthians 12, verses 15 through 18. It was God who designed and set the sex apparatus in the physical human body as it has pleased him. Then let us learn what we need to know about them without false modesty or foolish prudery, but as God would have us know. Follow this 12th chapter of 1 Corinthians a little further. The stern, harsh prudes who formulated a false, so-called Christian ethic about sex said of the genital system, "We have no need of you." God rebukes them, and they should, even in those early centuries, have read his rebuke. Here it is, beginning verse 21. "And the eye cannot say unto the hand, I have no need of you, nor again the head to the feet, I have no need of you. No, much more those members of the body which seem to be more feeble, Moffat, rather delicate or dishonorable, are necessary, and those members of the body which we think to be less honorable, sex, upon these we bestow more abundant honor, and our uncomely parts have more abundant comeliness." When we come to consider the human body from the mind of God, we see it not as something shameful and evil, but as something wonderful, to be understood with clean and healthy minds, in awe of the handiwork of the great designer. For this is what God beheld when he had formed it and pronounced, "Very good." The psalmist was inspired to cry out, "I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works." God has given each of us a marvelous human body to use as he has directed in his instruction book. The possession of such a body imposes on each individual a sacred responsibility. It is something you may use to God's honor and glory and to your own great happiness, or you may misuse and abuse it to dishonor the Creator and bring degradation, shame, and curses on yourself. The male genital system. First, then, we examine the masculine genital organs. God says through Paul, "Those physical organs of the body which humans regard as more uncomely, he has made very necessary with honor." And he continues, "Yes, God has tempered the body together with a special dignity for the inferior, uncomely parts, so that there may be no disunion in the body, but that the various members should have a common concern for one another." 1 Corinthians 12, verses 24 and 25, Moffat. And all this is compared to God's church, the body of Christ. It may seem to many that the most uncomely parts of the male body are those organs we now explain first, the germinal glands called testicles. That is, until the truth about them is learned, and then one should stand in awe at the divine mind and handiwork of the great God who designed and produced such a marvelous mechanism. See the matchless mind and hand of the Creator in these extremely necessary glands. Actually, they are the most important organs in the male generative apparatus. The testes are a pair of oval-shaped glands. They are enclosed in a cutaneous sac or bag called the scrotum. It is made up of several layers and is divided into two compartments, each containing a testicle. Each testicle is about the size of a hickory nut, approximately 1.5 inches long and 1 inch thick. The testes, with the scrotum, hang between the thighs, forward, underneath the base of the penis by the spermatic cord. The testes are located on the outside of the body. Did you ever wonder why? The Creator had a very good reason. This will be explained. Many men themselves do not realize it, but the left testicle hangs a little lower in the scrotum than the right. There is an important reason. Could blind evolution without intelligence have thought this out and made it thus? There is perhaps no pain a boy or man can suffer that is as excruciating as a crushing of or injury to the testicles. Did blind nature know this? Or did an all-intelligent creator, concerned for our welfare, design it so that in case the thighs are crowded together, one testicle will slip over the other, thus avoiding any crushing? No evolution here. Miniature colossal laboratories. When we understand what science tells us about these glands, we ought to be struck with amazement. Small as they are, still they are laboratories performing a colossal work going on day and night. They perform an astonishing dual activity. They produce both the germinal or reproductive cells, which impart human life to an otherwise infertile ovum, and also the hormones which cause the body to be masculine in shape, the voice to be masculine in tone, and the mind to be masculine in its thinking. And that's an incredible job to be performed by two small factories weighing less than an ounce each. Let's take a quick inspection of these laboratories that generate human life. Each small testicle contains a very large number of convoluted tubules, sometimes called seminiferous tubes, infinitely tiny. There are about 300 of them intertwined in a tiny but vast network of coils. If stretched out straight, the length of these tubules in the two testes would be approximately 1 mile in length, and all within factories only 1.5 inches in length. Astonishing, I should say. These tiny coils of tubules produce the male reproductive cells at an astounding rate, actually millions an hour, any one of which could impart a human life to an ovum. These male reproductive cells are called spermatozoa, singular spermatozoan, and are quite generally, in professional circles, called sperm cells for short, or sometimes just sperm. These sperm cells are unbelievably infinitesimal, the smallest cells in either male or female body. They are very different from any other cells in the human body. Each has a minute, egg-shaped head, an intermediate segment, and a tail comparatively long. They look, under a microscope, like tiny tadpoles. These infinitesimal cells cannot be seen with the naked eye, but are visible and measurable under a high-powered microscope. Each sperm is approximately 1/4,000th of an inch in length. Even the female egg cell or ovum is only about the size of a fine pinpoint, just barely visible to the naked eye, and a sperm cell is not more than about 1/50th as large as an ovum. Think of it. Each human being starts his existence in so miniature a size. Spermatozoa of animals are much larger than those of humans. The scientific authorities have now discovered that each human spermatozoan contains 23 chromosomes, and that it is through these that the characteristics of the father and also of grandparents are transmitted by heredity to the child. Of course, the mother's characteristics also are passed on through the nucleus within the ovum. The tiny intertwined tubules within each testicle in which the spermatozoa are produced are so narrow that a hair could not pass between them. This book is not intended, as mentioned before, to be a technical or professional scientific work, but I do feel that certain of these more technical facts are important, for the reader should come to a realization of the awesome mind and purpose of the Creator. This vast, intricate network of intertwined canals or convoluted tubules unite near the top to form a set of larger ones, the so-called vasa efferentia, and these in turn unite to form the epididymis. All this is enclosed within the scrotum. And finally, the tubules forming the epididymis converge into one seminal duct or tube called the vas deferens. The vas deferens continues up into the body carrying spermatozoa to the seminal vesicle, which will be explained later. As there are two testicles, there are also the vasa efferentia, the epididymis, and the vas deferens for each, terminating into the two seminal vesicles located beside or just under the bladder within the body. The male hormones. But before we leave the description of these tiny yet colossal laboratories, the testicles, there is still another most important function they perform. They produce also the male hormones. These are of vital importance and deserve a brief description. Scattered among these seminiferous tubules are microscopically tiny islands of cells. In these infinitesimal islands, the male hormones are produced. These are not carried through the vas deferens as are the spermatozoa, but pass directly into the bloodstream and thus circulate through the body. These male hormones cause changes in the shape of the body. Thus, from age of puberty, a boy's body develops into the masculine form. Narrow hips, wide shoulders for masculine strength, beard on the face, hair on the chest, and other parts of the body more than is common to females. The deeper voice. And these hormones directly influence the mind. There are certain pronounced differences between male and female minds, some of which will be explained later, although many of these are generally recognized by all. For example, little girls are interested in dolls and feminine things, little boys in machines and masculine things. Boys and girls are not sex conscious before the age of puberty in the same manner they become after puberty. Bodily changes become pronounced after puberty. Yet there are noticeable mind differences in young boys and girls. Tremendous importance. Let me illustrate further the enormous importance of these uncomely parts, which humans too often regard as less honorable, but on which the great designer has bestowed more abundant honor. Certain experiments made in the interests of science should teach us an impressive lesson. Perhaps in the sight of the eternal, such experiments ought not to be made, but men have made them, and the results are both intriguing and enlightening. As far back as history records, men have practiced castration. It is widely practiced today on animals, removing testes before male animals reach sexual maturity. You probably eat steer beef often and capon occasionally, to name just two examples. Of course, castration destroys reproductive capacity. No spermatozoa are produced. But also the male hormone production is destroyed, and that is the striking thing revealed by certain experiments. Of course, the castration practice in modern stock raising is not done primarily to destroy breeding capacity. It is done to alter the appearance and behavior of the animal. The stock raiser does not need a bull for every cow. One bull can take care of the breeding requirements for a number of cows. But steers make fatter and more tender steaks, and if the steer is not butchered for meat, the animal, which uncastrated would have grown into a wild bull, will, as a result of castration, become a docile ox, willing to work. The castration causes changes in bodily form and in the horns. Roosters and pigs are castrated to increase the poundage and therefore the profits. In the Bible, you read of castrated humans called eunuchs. Middle East sultans and other rulers used eunuchs to serve in harems. The eunuch lost all sexual desire. The harem women offered no temptation. They were once used at the papal court, said to be employed as singers because of their high-pitched voices. Eunuchs become obese, without beard or normal male hair growth on the body. However, even though castration is an age-old practice, much of the true importance of male testes and female ovaries was unknown until the experiments of Berthold in 1849. It had always been known, of course, that the comb of a castrated cock degenerates. But Berthold experimented further. He removed the testes of cocks and then regrafted these testes on the cocks' backs. The combs remained the same as in all uncastrated roosters. All bodily appearances remained the same. But, of course, all reproductive capacity was lost. This proved that the testes serve a dual purpose. Many similar experiments have been made since. They prove that the testes and ovaries not only serve to reproduce one's kind, they also determine the sex characteristics of the individual. Some astonishing experiments were made by the scientist of Vienna, Professor Steinach. First, he castrated both male and female animals of the same species. They both acquired a neutral appearance, neither male nor female. But this professor went further. He exchanged ovaries and testes. Into castrated males, he grafted female ovaries, and into the females, the germinal glands removed from the males. The former males now took on female characteristics, and the former females acquired those of males. The former females now behaved as males toward the former males, and the males now took on the behavior of females. Former males even developed mammary glands and nursed the young. Of course, there is much more to the hormone story than this. Other glands and other parts of the body have their coordinating relation to bodily characteristics, such as the pituitary, pineal, thyroid, and suprarenal glands. It is not our purpose to discuss them here, but what little has been covered about the hormones, it is hoped, will be of interest. Marvelous temperature gauge. The question has been asked, why are the testes located outside of the body? The great architect had a very good reason, but men never learned this reason until quite recent times. The earliest account of it I've been able to find dates from 1950. Scientists, it seems, stumbled onto this in making tests on animals to learn how long spermatozoa retain both their motility and their fertility at various temperatures. Then, in these experiments, the testes of rabbits were kept in a refrigerator. The sperm cells remained alive much longer than when kept at body temperature. So next, they made tests on live animals to determine what happens in testes at various temperatures. They discovered that the temperature inside the scrotum was several degrees lower than body heat. They made an experiment on male mice in a hatching oven at 110 degrees. They found fertility drastically reduced and soon nil. Test now followed test. They were learning things. So next they tried heating the testes alone, with bodies at normal temperatures. This experiment was made on sheep, goats, and pigs. The same thing happened. Fertility rapidly reduced until there were no fertile spermatozoa. Finally, a Dutch scientist determined that the temperature inside the human scrotum is actually 6 to 15 degrees lower than body temperature. It took men thousands of years to learn what the Creator planned and designed. Finally, men learned that these colossal yet miniature laboratories are so designed that they require this slightly lower temperature to produce fertile, life-imparting cells for the reproduction of the race. Then they discovered additional proof. In the fetal stage of development before birth, the testes first develop inside the male fetus and then descend into the scrotum some considerable time prior to birth through the inguinal canal. In all normal cases, male babies are born with the testes already in the scrotum. But it sometimes occurs that one or both testicles remain in the abdomen at and after birth. These infants are born with either a half-empty or wholly empty scrotum. Doctors today bring down the testes with a minor operation. Yet, when this was not known, there were cases where the testes remained after puberty and after marriage inside the body. Formerly, neither these men, nor, for that matter, medical science, could understand why such men appeared in every other way normal men. They could marry, they had normal desire and ability for coitus, yet they could not become fathers. Their testes were normal. They did manufacture spermatozoa, but not fertile sperms. They were sterile. Today it is known that the cause was simply that these marvelous and mighty little factories generating human life do not perform their wonderful operation of producing life-imparting sperm cells at bodily temperature. They must be kept at a temperature several degrees lower. So now scientists have at last learned something else. The scrotum, the sac which houses the testicles in Epididymides, is made up of a kind of skin different from any other in man or woman. It is a non-conductor of heat. It is made up of folds. In cold temperatures, or if the man is bathing or swimming in cold water, these folds shrink up and draw the testes up tight against the body, almost partially into it, lest the outside temperature become too cold for these marvelous little laboratories. But in very warm weather, they stretch out until the testes are dropped down a considerable distance farther from the warmer than normal body. Thus, this scrotum not only needed to be on the outside of the body, it also acts as an automatic temperature gauge to keep these little life-germinating factories producing at temperatures proper for their work. If you think Mother Nature, blindly and without mind, intelligence, or knowledge, planned and worked all this out, you are welcome to your ridiculous opinion. It was not dumb and stupid Mother Nature. It was the Supreme Father God who instructed Christ, who spoke and commanded, and the Holy Spirit was the power that brought it into being. If you think the evolutionary fable sounds more rational as a means of accounting for such wonders, well, of course you are allowed your opinions, however far from fact. The authorities speculate. These experimenting scientists deduce something further from their experiments. Their tests indicate that male sperm cells gradually lose both vigor or motility and also fertilizing power under the normal bodily temperature once deposited within the female body. Some experimenters insist spermatozoa retain power for fertilization only 48 hours and that ova must be fertilized within 24 hours in the fallopian tube. Thus, if this were true, there is only a period of a few hours in any month when human conception is possible. This discovery led to the rhythm cycle theory. But this so-called method of Planned Parenthood has, in fact, produced quite a bumper crop of babies. However, the doctors and scientists do not agree among themselves. A European authority says, this period of time is variously estimated. Some authorities think it is only from 24 to 36 hours. Others assume 8 or even 14 days. Taking into consideration the analogy of various animal species and practical experience rather than experimental research, I am inclined to believe in a long continuance of seminal vitality. Notice these expressions in the above quotation, typical of scientific language, as I've expressed in an earlier chapter. Variously estimated, some authorities think, others assume, and I am inclined to believe. We are dealing here not with the authority of revelation, but with the speculations, opinions, and guesses of science. Personally, I claim no authority save that of God. I have seen charts and medical books generally available only to doctors, and I have read many statements of experience which do indicate that pregnancy is possible at any time of the month. And so we have now covered the most important organs in the male generative apparatus. Female generative system. We come next to the equivalent system in the female. I am departing altogether from the method followed almost universally in the flood of books on the subject of sex in covering essentials of the sex organs. Instead of grouping the organs as to external and internal, male and then female, it seems more logical for our purposes here to describe them according to functional classification. The most important organs in the generative system of the female are the ovaries. There are certain similarities between the female ovaries and the male testes, yet, in other ways, they are quite dissimilar. The ovaries are located on the inside of the body. They do not, like the male generative laboratories, require lower than bodily temperature to do their work. They are, like the testes, a pair, located within the pelvis in the lower abdominal region, one on each side of the upper portion of the uterus. Also, like male testes, each ovary is about 1.5 inches in length, but they are more almond-shaped. They are connected to the uterus by a pair of ducts called fallopian tubes. The ovaries produce the egg cells, called ova, singular ovum. When an ovum is fertilized by a sperm cell, it is the start of a new human life. In each ovary, many egg cells, ova, between the age of puberty and menopause are in various stages of development, but ova are produced very much more slowly than spermatozoa. A mature ovum is released from the ovaries about once every 4 weeks, alternating every other month, so that each ovary produces a mature ovum approximately every 8 weeks. Each ovum is an almost round or globular cell, about the size of a pinpoint, just barely discernible by the naked eye if your eyes are really sharp. Yet, tiny as they are, each ovum is about 50 times larger than a spermatozoan. As they are produced inside the ovary, each ovum is surrounded by and enclosed in a sort of very tiny bladder called a Graafian follicle. This follicle is filled with fluid. As each ovum matures, enclosed in this follicle, it is developed in the outer layer of the ovary. This causes the outer ovarian wall to bulge. Then the Graafian follicle bursts, or rather explodes its contents out into the abdomen. The ovum is caused to bounce out like a ball into the fringed or near funnel-shaped end of the fallopian tube. This fringed end of the fallopian tube, shaped something like a carnation flower, seems to open like an outstretched hand to receive the ovum, which is virtually shot into it. It opens only when an ovum is mature and ready to be released into it. This discharge of the ovum from the ovary into the fallopian tube is called ovulation. The female hormones. At this same instant, something else quite interesting and very important happens. The female sex hormone is called follicular hormone because it is formed within this membranous envelope or follicle. When the follicle bursts, only the infinitesimal round ovum is shot into the oviduct, fallopian tube. The follicular hormone is then released into the abdomen, absorbed into the bloodstream, and thus carried by the blood to do its work in various parts of the body.
This completes tape number 3, side number 2 of The Missing Dimension in Sex. Please continue on tape number 4.